Welcome to the Build Up on Balls.ie in association with Ladbrokes. Please bet responsibly. Visit dunlewy.net for further information.
Hello and welcome to the Build Up on Balls.ie, our podcast in association with Ladbrokes. We come to you every week. We usually would be hyping up for the sporting weekend, but obviously over the last few weeks, there has not been any sport to get hyped for, but we have been keeping you entertained, hopefully, with some really interesting chats with some of our Ladbrokes ambassadors. And this week will be no different. We'll be talking to Stephen Ferris and Jason Quigley about their favourite coaches and what makes a great coach. But I'm back in the hot seat, Mark Farley, this week, and I'm joined by Donny Mahoney. Mick is off. Donny, how are you?
I'm great. You know, keeping well, doing my best.
I have big news, right? So I was off last week, and obviously, we're suffering for lack of sport here. We all the sports fans are trying to keep themselves occupied. And I fell down the rabbit hole of Football Manager.
Okay.
I started a Football Manager 20 journey. I'm managing Sunderland.
Okay.
First thing I did was I brought Aaron Connolly in on loan.
Okay.
The second thing I did was I brought Troy Parrott in on loan. And the third thing I did was I bought Jack Byrne. What an attacking trio that is.
That's very good. And how have you been doing?
I'm 20 games into the league and I'm still unbeaten.
Wow.
I've drawn a lot of games there. I'm only like 4 or 5 points clear at the top of the table. But, you know, things are going well. Stuart Arnold is his name? The chairman, the Sunderland chairman. He's planning to sell the club, unfortunately. He's been in discussions a couple of times. I've had a transfer embargo and everything. Things are very close to being a done deal. So I don't know what, you know, maybe the new owner is going to come in and decide that my tiki-taka style is not for them and not for League One. But we'll have to see. The boys are doing all right. They've kind of got on. Troy Parrott scored his debut, then got injured and was out for 5 or 6 weeks and kind of struggled for form since he came back. Aaron Connolly scored 5 goals in his first 5 league games, then only 1 in the next 10, I think, which has been an issue for me. And also, Will Griggs not happy because he's been kind of moved to pushed aside because of the two young guns coming in.
He's not on fire at the moment, though.
No, he's definitely not on fire. Grant Ledbetter has come to me in private to tell me that Will is not happy. So he just wanted to give me a heads up. He didn't want it to boil over, and he sensed his mood was down.
How much time do you need to put into Football Manager to really get something out of it on a daily basis? I'm going to confess I've never played it once.
The more recent ones have become a lot more consuming, but like, what I've discovered is a bit of a hack in that you just hire a director of football and assign all the different bits to them, because like you can manage under 18s, you can manage under 23s, you can decide, you know, hire your own coaching staff, physios, everything for each team, decide what coaches, you know, to send them on, what courses to send them on for licenses, all this. So there's an awful lot. There's literally every, you know, like when we're doing this, we're running this poll, obviously the topic is managers and coaches the last couple of weeks here with the poll we're running on the site and association of Ladbrokes to crown the best manager in Irish sports history. And I have a lot of sympathy for them because, as I'm sure we're going to chat to the lads later on, they're going to talk about, like, you know, the fact that there's so much, it's not just coaching players, it's not just being on the pitch, there's so much more to it. And I'm very appreciative of the work that these lads have gone, these real-life managers have to go through. But, look, you can also just assign everything to director of football and football manager and just play your games, assign training to him, to your assistant manager. He takes control of that. And then you're just kind of jumping from game to game, making transfers. That's all anyone really wants to do, making transfers and going gung-ho at the end.
I heard a great story about Obama that when he became president of the United States, he basically got rid of all his old suits. And then he only got 2 kinds of suits, blue suits and black suits. And so basically every day he had to sort of, you know, he kind of, reduce the amount of decisions he had to make when he got out of bed, because it was like he had so many big decisions to make in a day. He's like, why get hung up on these little decisions that could trip us up? And that's kind of the sign of a great manager, I guess. Also, an ability to delegate and to kind of find the sort of specialists who can help you out in your job. I think it's not just this sort of impassioned speech that from Friday Night Lights or something that we think of when we think of managers. You know, there's much more to it.
Definitely, and I think I've shown that in my football manager experience last week by knowing when to delegate, what to take on yourself. I take control of the team talks. I don't bother going to the press conferences, not because I just need to try and get through the season quicker, but because I know that my assistant Steve Parkin is going to be more comfortable dealing with the press. And obviously, I'm compromised being part of that press already.
Sure.
But anyway,
and you're not threatened by Steve. you don't think he's coming for your job. You guys have a good working relationship.
We do. Yeah, we've gotten along. I didn't know him well, I'm going to admit, when I took the job. I didn't know him at all. We'd never met each other. But since that, we've grown to become good friends. I've hired Patrice Everett and Ian Robin as coaches as well, by the way. And Ian's very, very eager to learn. He's come looking to do two courses already. He wants to get his continental license. And thankfully, Stuart's been accommodating and giving us the funding to send him on those courses. So all's going well so far. But I will be revealed in next season's Sunderland Till I Die how we get on at the end of the season. But we have to move on to more important matters. We're going to chat to Stephen Ferris and Jason Quigley about their own experiences as players and as a boxer, that in terms of who are the best coaches they've worked with, what makes a great coach. And then we're also going to reveal later on in the show the finalists of our vote. So the semi-final is open right now. We're going to have PJ Brown on the line as well. And we're going to chat through the final of our vote, crown the best sports manager in Irish sports history. It's very close. That's all I'm going to say for the minute. But right now, let's jump into our chat with Stephen Ferris and Jason Quigley. We're delighted now to be joined by Ladbrokes ambassador Stephen Ferris and Jason Quigley. Craig, lads, what's the crack?
Very little. Enjoying the sunshine.
It looks like it.
Just trying to get more female viewers, like, you know.
Definitely, it was good to enjoy the weather when we can. But this week we are chatting about coaches. Obviously, as we mentioned on the podcast earlier, we're in the middle of a vote in association with Ladbrokes at the minute to crown the greatest coach or manager in Irish sports history. So this week, lads, we're going to chat about your favourite coaches and what you think makes a great coach. So, Jason, we'll start with you. I suppose, like, there's the obvious people to mention in terms of Andy Lee and Billy Walsh and the like. But when you were growing up, who were the standout coaches that you worked with, and who were the ones that influenced you the most?
There was a lad, Jim Moore, that coached us on the national team, on the development squad, like coming up through schoolboys and youths and everything they got there. And his son was a great boxer as well, James Moore. People might have heard of him. Jim wouldn't have been your typical boxing coach, and I think that's why it made him so special. He had a way with the boxers, and Jim wouldn't come in roaring and shouting and just eating ahead of you for nothing. Like, Jim would have come in very cool, calm, relaxed, and whatever Jim said, you knew he meant it. And if you'd have got a bad look from Jim or a shake of the head, that would have been more disappointing than him roaring and shouting at you that you're not doing things right. So that was the type of person that Jim was, and, you know, people really took to Jim in that way because they knew he was sincere. They knew that he didn't waste his time. If you wanted to go mess around, you went and messed around. But he wouldn't have paid no attention. He wouldn't have given you his time. And I think that's what's special in a lot of coaches. Like, Jim Moore is definitely one of the lads that I look up to as a coach. And, you know, going back through my younger years through the boxing, he was definitely one of the lads that that molded me, you could say, in a certain way. And he's a top class lad, and he never really took into the senior professional or the senior Irish team and coaching or anything like that there. And it's something that I think that was thrown at him a few times, that it was a possibility, but Jim was probably in it too long and seen the politics of things and everything that got there, and was like, "Now I've had enough," and he trained some great champions throughout the years.
When you're, like, in terms of boxing, how much of it is at a younger age? Like, you'll say it with football or whatever it is, that you can go out, and a lot of it is, you know, the person on their own can just kind of develop the skills or whatever it is. But boxing, how much is it trying to get coaching from an early age in terms of technique, that, like, how much of it is kind of natural talent then balanced with the coach that maybe gives you direction, both in terms of as a person, but also in terms of the actual, the way maybe they'll know the stuff straight away? How much of it is kind of that kind of balance, I suppose, is hard to get?
Yeah, I think everyone will know that the majority of boxers are a bit hot-headed and wild and crazy and things like that there. So, you know, I think a good boxing coach is somebody that can create a relationship with the fighter himself. You know, be able to talk to the fighter, not just about boxing, be able to talk to the fighter about family, about girlfriends, about money, about cars, about just normal day-to-day life things that we go through. Because the majority of boxers, like, we don't come from doctoring or school families with loads of money. Like, most boxers come from a pretty average upbringing to sometimes difficult upbringings. And, you know, we need, majority of us now, we need, you know, that kind of arm around your shoulder and to be able to talk to you, to be able to guide you along in life more so than boxing, because boxing is a very unique sport. You either have it or you don't. Like, there's not too many people as mad as boxers out there that want to get into the ring and get their heads beaten, like, you know what I mean? So it's a crazy individual sport, so it is. And most boxers are crazy in their own right. But I think it takes the type of a coach that's able to calm a boxer, to be able to make them look at the life goals, the life outside of the sport, and to just guide them along, as I said before, you know, talk to them about the basic stuff, family, girlfriends, money, cars, things that you go through growing up, and gain that trust in the boxer. And because when you're in that ring, the only person that is in there with you is that 1 minute break between the rounds, and that's your coach.
Stephen, who were the standout coaches for you when you were a youngster?
I've gone through, I've racked my brain over the last couple of days thinking about all the coaches that I've worked with, and obviously they work with me and a lot of other different players along the way. But suppose, like, at school level, it was always like a teacher who finished class and then come out and, you know, added in, and, you know, they were just more or less giving up an hour of their time after school to pitch in. And to be honest here, I think in the north, I'd say the majority of the coaches that are school teachers up here don't have any badges, aren't qualified. You know, they're just there to pitch in and lend a hand, especially at the school friends where I was at. You had Barney McGonagall, obviously, who is still involved in some of the Irish underage teams in terms of the management. But he did very little coaching. He just overseen everything. But Barney, I suppose, was the person that put a rugby ball in my hand. So I've got to thank him. Like, and I think progressing through, it was maybe only until I got to Portadown under 18s. There was a fella, a Scottish guy called Tom McGall, who's actually way back. He lives back in Scotland now. And he was exceptionally good. He understood that, like, we were all 16, 17 years of age. We were kids starting to become adults, and I think at that age you gotta let younger lads who are taking a wee bit longer to grow up. You know, you gotta allow them to go through that period. You can't just, because it's a bit more of a higher standard, just all of a sudden make it ultra professional. You know, you gotta let young lads go out and enjoy themselves, and that's more or less what he did. Yes, we knuckled down when it came to team training sessions. He was a good man manager, a good delegator, had a couple of good guys around him, a few of which are still involved in Portadown Rugby Club. And then that was sort of my first taste of good, half-decent coaching. We went on, obviously, to achieve a hell of a lot with Portadown under 18s. And then I made the move a couple of years later to Jeremy Davison, who's now head coach at Brive, has been around a few different clubs in France with Cast, Bordeaux Begle. And obviously I work with him as well at Ulster, who, you know, Big Jeremy, probably one of the most unprepared coaches I've ever worked with. But at the same time, that wasn't his strength. His strength was getting the best out of you when it came to a match night, getting the best out of you when it came to a physical contact training session. And people have their own opinions. Jason will absolutely back me up in this. I've said this many a time before, if a coach picks you, and a coach selects you, you will think that coach is good. If the coach doesn't select you, mm-hmm. and you're not involved in the 23, then the coach is rubbish. And I've seen so many good coaches along the years who haven't selected certain players, and I've had coffees with them, and they were telling me how bad he is, and he's this, that, and the other. And I'm like, geez, I actually think he's pretty good. But the reason was because I was getting picked and he wasn't. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of different opinions of different coaches out there. And as we all know, the coaching game is very short-lived. It certainly is in professional rugby, and coaches come and go. But a couple there, Tom McGall at Portadown under-18s and Jeremy Davison, were the two coaches that really got me started.
Yeah, for both of you as well, I was thinking it's something that probably we don't pass much remarks of, but it's probably both important for you in terms of making that decision to step, you know, to go, I'm going to pursue this as a professional career. Were there coaches there that were involved in that when you're trying, you know, that were egging you on or giving you advice or mentoring you in that way?
For me, like, I can remember I was down at the Deer Park Hotel there in Howth in Dublin, and it was with Irish under, I think it was maybe Irish youth or under 18s, 19, something along those lines. And I caught up with Barney McGonagall, like, he obviously my schoolmaster. And he said to me, he said, Stevie, there's going to be one if lucky, guys, out of all this, all the boys in the room here, and there's maybe 25, 30 lads, more 40 lads in the room, that'll go on to make it as a professional rugby player. And I went, yeah, good one. I kind of laughed it off. And yes, there was that jump then the following year when all the school lads came in and we all mixed together. But like, looking back on it, he was right. And I was the only one that made it out of that group of players. But at that period of time, Mark, I couldn't care less if I became a professional rugby player. Like, all I was doing was enjoying my rugby, enjoying the crack with the boys. It was a brilliant experience. My mum was getting me out of the house for 3 or 4 days at a time. And I was just enjoying life experiences, going away to Scotland for a Four Nations tournament, spent 2 weeks in Edinburgh with a bunch of lads. You know, I think that's the memories that I take out of it. But it probably wasn't until I get into the Ulster Academy and, you know, a few people are blowing smoke up your backside and you go, geez, well, maybe there is something in this for me. That's when I kind of, maybe 18, 19 years of age, kind of, I felt that there might have been a career for me in rugby.
Jason, you obviously had the big decision to make in terms of turning pro or going to the Olympics as well, which is probably a difficult one with the likes of Billy Walsh and whoever, who are kind of torn between, well, geez, we want Jason here, but then also thinking of what's best for your career.
Yeah, Ken, I had a funny kind of a relationship towards the end of my amateur career. Like, my father was obviously a big part of my boxing career. He was my coach for most of my boxing career, like, you know what I mean, right up until I was on the Irish national team. And you know, my best year in the national team, I went out and won everything around me, and I was a hot topic at that time. And it was about 2 years to the Olympic Games, 2 or 3 years to the Olympic Games, and I had just won the world silver medal and the European gold. And people was all looking at me, oh, this is Ireland's next medal hope at the Olympic Games and in Rio and things like that. So there was, and that was my head, like, that's what I was gunning for and that's what I was aiming for. And I was finally succeeded and secured my place on the top funding on the national team. I was getting well paid. Everything was falling into my lap and everything like that. You know, it was all going swimmingly well for me. And then the pro offers started coming in. And I was like from Golden Boy, Top Rank, all the top lads out there were looking to sign me up. And it was unbelievable. Like, I was like, this is brilliant. But it was probably one of the most difficult times in my professional career and my entire boxing career, even including the injury, because I was happy on the Irish boxing team, the amateur team. I was, you know, looking forward to Olympic Games, qualifiers, everything I got there. I was, you know, getting great funding, well looked after, and I was also getting a bright future thrown at me as well by the big dogs in the professional game. So it was a lot of over and back and thinking what's the right thing to do. And I was trying to please other people as well. Like, I didn't want to let Billy Walsh and the team down. And, you know, then I didn't want to let my father was, you know, pushing towards the professional game. And I was kind of more towards the amateur game because I was comfortable with it. I'd finally slotted my number one place on the team. I was, as it says, look, everything was going well for me on the national team at that stage. And weeks became months, and it became up to nearly a half a year that I hadn't been in the Irish team. I had been sitting at home going over contracts, trying to turn pro, trying to get the best contract possible. And it was a very difficult time because all I wanted to do was just get in the ring and fight. I didn't care whether it was amateur. I didn't care whether it was professional at this stage. And I ended up going over to LA. And obviously I was given all the star treatment over there. And I was easily turned at that stage. So I was. And the bright lights over there now was very tempting. And it got me, you know what I mean? And I turned over professional. I look back now and do I look and say, I would have loved to have went to the Olympic Games. Of course, I would have loved to have represented my country at the Olympic Games. The way the Olympic Games went, I was kind of looking at it saying, kind of glad I didn't hang around for the Olympic Games, the way the politics of the Russians and the judging and everything like that there, you know. So I had a lot of back and forwards with Billy Walsh. Obviously, I had a lot of trust and a lot of belief in Billy. And, you know, Billy's a top man and a massive part of my boxing career. And then I had my father back at home as well, you know, kind of both on each shoulder with me. It was difficult times. And I had to go with what I felt then deep down inside me. And, you know, Billy was wanting me to stay, go to the Olympic Games. My father was wanting me to go professional. And there was just one night where I was sitting back and I was saying, why did I start boxing? I started boxing because I watched Marco Antonio Barrera beat Prince Nassim Hamed. Absolutely schooled him. And that was the first time ever I got hairs on the back of my neck. It was the first time I ever got anything like that about a sport or about anything. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. And that was professional boxing. I always wanted to be a professional world champion. So that's the reason then why I turned around and says, I'm going to go professional, because that was the drive from the very, very start. That was the fire burning deep down inside me. So I had to stick with that, and still not there yet, but we're still climbing that ladder.
Steve, what was, we were thinking on the best Irish rugby coaches of the last 20, 30 years, and we're trying to get a sense of Declan Kidney's overall kind of place in the hierarchy of Irish sport. And I was always curious what it was like working with him in 2009 and what kind of role he would have played in shaping your team. Like, he didn't seem like the most charismatic kind of coach. And I'm just wondering what it was like to sort of slot in there and work under him, having been under the kind of Ulster kind of umbrella for a while.
Yeah, it's a good question, Donny. First of all, I love your wallpaper. It looks really nice.
Thanks very much. It's my wife's.
I'm only winding you up. But no, it's interesting, lads. I think looking at your poll at the minute and looking at all the managers and coaches that are in your poll and reading through all the comments and seeing, you know, who favours who, and, you know, Joe Smith, he's getting absolutely blasted for leapfrog and a five-time All-Ireland coach, you know, and then, like, Declan Kidney's not even making it. And, like, Declan Kidney made history. He got us to win the Grand Slam in 2009, which hadn't been done in decades. And, you know, I think he's a type of coach that is... He's a bit of a funny duddy, like. He's a type of character that would just walk into a room and try and slag you for just the sake of trying to slag you. And then, in terms of his coaching ability, Decky didn't do much coaching. If you ask Rog, if you ask Dricko, if you ask any of the lads, he let Alan Gaffney, you know, take the backs. He let Gert Small take the forwards. Like, he let Dricko have a massive influence in what the backs were doing, and Rog and Sexto and all the guys. You know, obviously, Paulie ran the line out, and then he brought in Greg Feek for the scrum specialist. And he was very, very good at building a good team around him. And I think he's trying to do the same at London Irish at the minute. But there's no doubting that Declan Kidney was a good manager. Obviously, and that's actually been talked about recently, Donnie, about the way professional rugby is. I think it's sort of unfair that, you know, Leo Collin gets, you know, the title, or most of the head coaches get the title of head coach. It's not really. It's more like football. It is a manager, you know. You have guys, of course, like Richard Cockerell at Edinburgh, who's very hands-on and loves to, you know, be in the middle of it. But generally, I'd say 70-80% of all these head coaches, or, you know, the powers right at the top, do very little coaching. You know, they're the guys that they're bringing in a lot of people. And Decky was very, very good in that, just to touch on Decky. And yeah, of course, he had his favourites. He worked with, you know, Munster for a long, long time. You're always going to have that. Somebody who I had the utmost respect for. But as a in terms of his technical coaching ability, he probably wouldn't be up there. But in terms of his managerial kind of circumstances, I think he would be up there.
In terms of the balance between international rugby and then back with Ulster, like, how much can actual international coaches, whether it be the head coach or the backing staff, change you as a player? Or is it mostly, you know, tactics and strategy and plays, rather than kind of actually the ins and outs of what the technical ability is there?
Yeah, like, I suppose from my own personal point of view, all I wanted a coach was to give me direction. So if it was to make me a little bit better passing off my left hand, or breaking through the tackle and looking for the offload, using my footwork instead of trying to use brute force, and just trying to add another string to your bow all the time. The worst coaches are the coaches that think they know absolutely everything. Somebody like Matt Williams, like, you know, trying to teach Rory Best how to throw the ball in the line-out, you know, trying to teach David Humphreys how to knock it between the sticks from 40 yards out. Like, you know, these are the coaches that I think really are a wee bit more old school. And the new breed of coaches seem to have a much better idea of what they need. And they bring in other coaches, they bring in specialists, they bring in, you know, if it's Jason, they bring in guys to work on his defence. They, you know, they go through hours and hours and hours of video clips to try and help your game. And I think, Mark, you know, there was such a high turnover of coaches. Like, you know, I think at Ulster in three or four seasons, we went through six or seven coaches. Like, not all those lads were head coaches, but again, you're talking like kit men, you know, bag men have a huge influence. You know, somebody like Ralla within Ireland, somebody like Big Mick up at Ulster, and Nigel Brady, former Ulster player. You know, all these skills coaches that are now involved, they all have an impact. And I think a high turnover is really difficult, like in any bloody business, for goodness sake, you know. So it's all about, and that's why I think Leinster have been so successful over the last few years. There's so much stability. Leo Collin goes, oh, do you know what? I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll bring in Felipe Contepomi just for a couple of seasons. We'll bring in Dennis Leamy. We'll drag him up from Munster and we'll put him into the Leinster Academy. You know, wealth of experience. And that's where they've got it right. You know, they really have. So, lots of worked under probably too many coaches, Mark. And as I said, there are a few of those lads talk too much and think they know it all, where thankfully the majority of them understand the game and know that they don't know it all.
Yeah. Either of you lads see yourselves coaching down the line?
Jason? Well, me personally, no. At the minute, probably not. I coached my school there a couple of years ago. Got the Medallion Shield final, which was fantastic. The lads ran out at Kingspan Stadium, and you know what a day. Unfortunately, got beaten by Armagh by a couple of points, which is now coached by Willie Falloon. If you remember, Willie Falloon played for Ulster, played for Connacht, and he's massively into the coaching, and there's rumours of him getting a job within the Ulster Academy. So there are pathways there if you want to try and go down that route, for sure. But for me at the minute, I think I'm enjoying myself outside of the game, and I'm working on it from a broadcaster point of view. But would I want to get back in with 12, 13, 14, 15 year olds and, start to go back to basics again? At this moment in time, No, but who knows what the, who knows what sure. the future holds, Donny.
It's definitely like rugby as well, because I was thinking that looking at even, you know, and Declan Kinney was a good example for like after he left Ireland and how they were saying the short shelf life of it, and some of the Ulster coaches as well that you would have worked with. Like, it's because it's such a small pool, it's hard to, you know, we're going to have this as a career going forward for a couple of decades.
Yeah, like when I retired and people were saying, "Are you going to get into coaching?" I'm like, geez, I've traveled the world. Like every weekend or every other weekend, you're away, whether you're in Cardiff or Edinburgh. And, you know, there's a lot, so much bouncing around. And if you're a coach, like, you know, you look at somebody like Mark Anscombe, you know, he was at Ulster for a couple of years. He's been here, there, and everywhere. You know, Canada, back to Wales again, Ulster, New Zealand. You know, you have to be able to be flexible. And for somebody like me who's a little bit younger than somebody like Mark, I think at the minute I'm happy to be at home. I think you need to be the type of person that if you get sacked in the morning, you're happy enough just to jump on a plane and go and try and take another job, because it is getting more and more like football. Like, it really is in the professional game of rugby. And why? Because of that, because of the money. And, you know, if you're not succeeding, they'll quickly dispose of you and get somebody else in to try and make amends. So it's probably slightly more different from boxing.
Jason, how's it been working with Andy since you've gone? Andy's your third head coach since you've gone pro, isn't he? And how was it? Like, what are the differences that you find as well? Because, like Steve was saying, in terms of being here, there, and everywhere, you had the same thing in terms of, you know, you have to, you're in California, Sheffield. It's kind of it's hard to know where to be sometimes, really.
Yeah, like I think with exactly what Steven says, you know, that title being head coach, or, you know, sometimes it doesn't justify, I think, the team or the boxer. Like, you might be one individual boxer, but you have a team around you, and especially in, whether it's a rugby team, a football team, whatever, you know, you need to have that balance and you need to have that leeway where you say, well, okay, that's not my best attribute there. I'm going to get somebody else in that can do that job better than me. And I think it's having that head coach that's willing to give leeway to other coaches and other parts of the staff that come in to help. I think that's a massive part. And, you know, I think everyone's watching The Last Dance now at the minute. And is it Phil Jackson or Tim Jackson? Is
Phil, the coach, yeah. There?
So, yeah, you know, like, but was it 1 week before the finals that the Chicago Bulls were in? Like, so he just gave them the day off, and Michael Jackson went away golfing, and, you know, they went away doing their things. Okay, Michael Jordan. That no Michael Jackson.
Bad as he's gone.
They brought him up for the footwork.
I'm never going to let you live this
time. Oh, Michael Jordan. Like, I suppose a man with that talent, you can give him certain leeway, but, you know, there's players on that team that needed certain treatment that Phil Jackson was able to give them, whereas other coaches wouldn't be able to give that type of leeway. Like, I think he got to know the players individually, knew what they needed, and brought that into all around the team, so that the team knew exactly where they were going. They knew that every single one of them was individual in their own right, but all chasing the same goal and the same dream of becoming the champions. And I think in boxing, you need that also. Like, going right back to what Steven was saying, like the kit man and things like that. Like, I don't know much about kit men, but I'm sure the kit men are good crack. Like, you know what I mean? They're always, like, they have such a serious role, but it is a very important role to keep the atmosphere light and to have a bit of fun, to have a bit of crack, you know. Every aspect of the game is very important, and every person in your team is vital in terms of the environment and the energy that they bring into the changing rooms, they bring into the gym, they bring onto the pitch, they bring into the ring, whatever it shall be. But for me, I have just now, I think I have everything in the right place. I'm sure there's maybe areas that I could make a little better and things like that. But as of now, me being in Dublin, training is a massive help for me. Me training with Andy, stylistically wise, with the way that Andy boxed, the way that I boxed, the amateur background coming from Andy and myself, and the age difference as well, I think is a massive thing as well. Like, me and Andy just get each other. Like, he's not that, he'll say he's not that older than me. He's a few years older than me. we're in that age bracket, and like, Andy could get back in the ring after a good training camp and compete still at a very, very high level, you know. So to have that kind of atmosphere and that kind of relationship with each other is very important also. And I think that's the good thing about boxing, is that you can get a more personal and a more in-depth relationship because it's more one-on-one. So for me, it was a mixture of everything. In LA, I had a great coach as well, Manny Robles. Mexican coach, taught me how to fight, taught me how to put the hands up and let loads of shots go. You know what I mean? Like, the real Mexican style type of fighting. And then I moved over to Sheffield to Dominic Ingle. The Ingle way of boxing is very abstract as well. And for me, I look back and don't say, oh, geez, I wish I had made this move quicker, or I wish it didn't go here or there. I've took certain things from each coach, from each trainer that has taught me, whether it's inside fighting with Manny, whether it's elusive boxing and very acrobatic with the angles, or whether it's now with Andy, getting back to what I do best and my structure and everything like that, and implementing different little styles, different little techniques into my game. All these here have a massive part to play now, and that's why I'm using them all as best I can. But it's the whole environment. It's not just one coach. It's not just one manager, nothing like that. I think it's the whole environment that creates a successful team. And although boxing might be an individual sport, we still go in there as a team. We still wear the team Quigley tracksuits. We still get in there and represent as a team. And I think it's vital that you can get a coach or a trainer or a manager out there that you can relate with, that you can talk with, as it says previous in the podcast, that you can just talk with about life in general. I think it's massive to gain that trust.
Good stuff, lads. Thanks a million. Thanks very much for taking time to chat with us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
No worries. Cheers, boys. Yeah,
up there from Stephen and Jason, as always. You can also catch, if you didn't listen to last week's podcast, we chatted with Kevin Doyle about all the different managers he's had, who stood out the most. And he's had quite a few managers over his sporting career. It was a brilliant listen. So make sure to, after you finish listening to this one, make sure and jump back to listen to last week's podcast as well. Right now, though, myself and Donnie are also joined by PJ Brown. And PJ, you've come on here to chat about our finalists in the vote for the best manager in the history of Irish sport. And as a proud Kerry man, I'm very happy to let you know that Mick O'Dwyer has made the final.
Yes. But it's the victory Kerry needed in the middle of this this emergency. I'm worried by the what kind of over-the-top celebrations are going to erupt down in Killarney now. Down in Waterville, I suppose.
Yeah. But also, PJ, no one Kerry people, you know, this is nothing unless he's win the finals. So, thankfully, Kerry don't travel for a semi-final because we want everybody to stay at home. But it was an incredibly close vote between him and Jack Charlton. Mick has secured it with 51% of the vote, and he's going to take on Brian Cody, who was a much more convincing winner over Joe Smith in the other semi-final. So it's an all GAA final. It's the football, one of those decorated football managers against the most decorated hurling manager. And lads, where's the vote going to go?
Well, I think I'm just say that I'm just a bit stunned that it's come to this. It just seemed like from watching the votes as we got here, it was Jack just steamrolled through Jim McGuinness. He steamrolled Kevin Heffo Heffernan. And from early votes on Monday evening, it just seemed like he was in a strong position. But obviously, the sort of Kerry internet mafia got behind this, and Mikko has got there. I think what you realize when you do these polls is just the love that people have for certain coaches, and people really love Cody. I mean, he really is. He kind of epitomizes everything that we love in a manager, and his longevity, the fact that he's still going and still managing in 2020, I think is only going to stand to him in this vote, and I think he'll probably get my vote.
Cody's getting your vote.
Would you believe this? I think I'd actually vote for Brian Cody as well.
What?
This is the vote for like the greatest Irish manager of all time. So the standards are pretty high, and Mikko won 8 All Irelands, but he mainly did that with the same team. Like, so the team he had in 75 when they won first was largely like a lot of that was the same team, same lads were there. But at the time they won in 86, and so he stays on for another couple of years, and Kerry ended up in the wilderness. That was because because Mikko didn't really plan for the future. So he won those 8 All-Irelands with one team, whereas Cody has had maybe four to five different teams over his nearly 22 years in charge. So like the team that got to the All-Ireland last year had 6 new players on it from the one which got to the All-Ireland final in 3 years beforehand. And I think there's a lot in that when Brian Cody does eventually leave, he leaves Kilkenny in a good place, as in they'll still be very competitive, whereas Mikko didn't do that. You know, he was they were winning now. They wanted to win now.
The one thing though for Mikko was that, as well, is that like Cody's done this, and he's done it with the greatest Hurling County in Ireland. He's managed, because it's still an incredible feat, not to take away from him. I was just trying to make the argument, make the case for O'Dwyer, in that he goes off in a different era, wins 2 Leinster championships with Kildare, wins a Leinster championship with Laois, gets Kildare to an All-Ireland final. He went even with Wicklow, he got a kick out of them as well. It's like he did prove that he had the ability to do it, and not just with, the vote kind of had the best counties for the respective codes, and then Mick went off and did it as well with others.
Yeah, I do think that Mikko's time away from Kerry does stand to him. Weirdly, I kind of think of him with Wicklow as just like, a county with no track record of any success just suddenly being relevant and dangerous just shows his sort of powers. Even if his methods have been scrutinized over the years, and there's been some kind of revisionism about how good of a coach he actually was, but I think his time away from Kerry stands to him. But it's just, I think Cody's achievements, he's been imperious for so long there. I think it makes him hard to beat. I mean, I don't know, Kilkenny, was hurling very competitive between 2006 and 2010. I don't know, maybe that Kilkenny team was good at a down point for everybody else. I don't know, but I think it's hard to look past Cody.
Yeah, like it's not that I don't rate the achievements outside of Kerry. I mean, he won 4 games at Wicklow in 2009. They won 4 games. Wicklow won 4 games in the championship. They got into the last round of the qualifiers. Ended up losing to Kildare, not by a massive margin. There is, I know, maybe it's just me as a Kerry man that, what I rate the most is those, what he did with Kerry. And I just, for me, I think I would pick Cody.
Yeah, love it. I think I would do the same. It's just it is choosing. I think, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think back over the bracket. I think we have the two most deserving managers / head coaches in the final. Mm-hmm. Do you agree? I don't think there's no massive argument that X person should be ahead of them. I know. Well,
I might just jump in and say Big Jack, in what he did, like, as a sort of presence in Irish sport. I thought, while, you know, like, he doesn't have the silverware with Ireland to show for what he achieved and how, you know, as his beloved character that is almost bigger than the sport, I thought he would almost get an automatic sort of bye to the final. So I'm surprised to see Mikko achieve to kind of pass him out. But that's the only one I could really, like, of all the other, everyone on this, of the 16 are great at what they do, but I just thought his sort of achievements were bigger than his sport, and he sort of belonged in a final. But that might just be me.
It is. I mean, football is also our most popular sport. It is.
Yeah.
I do wonder, is there a little bit in, I mean, like, they were up against, it was these two GA icons up against two adopted sons of Ireland. Mm. They weren't, you know, maybe there is something in that. Maybe we were voting for the Irish there a little bit. Well, I probably would have picked Mikko over Jack anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is something in Jack in that we got to like a World Cup quarterfinal, but maybe you kind of wonder the players he had under him that he could have done a bit more of them. They were players who could play football, and a lot of the time they didn't. So maybe, like, at the back of my mind, I think that probably is a strike against him.
Yeah, definitely. I think, like, it's weird. Jack Charlton, for Jack, I think, like, you kind of nearly need, you'd love a different manager to manage Ireland in a parallel universe at the same time and see what they got out of them. Because on one hand, you're like, he completely transformed Ireland. Like, we had no Irish football history in terms of major international tournaments before he came along, and he transformed that team. He, you know, the whole put him under pressure. Obviously, it's some of the best sport memories in the history of the country. But at the same time, as you say, PJ, it's like, should David O'Leary have been in that team for all those years? Should they have been, you know, the likes, you know, there's so many different players that could have blossomed had they played a more technical style. So it's hard to know, because they could have tried that and got nowhere. We never, you know, it is kind of a weird one. But, like, I don't know, I can't, like, when, you know, you've got, if you're going by the judgment of Mr. Raymond Dunphy, he'll mention the Brian Codys, and he'll throw pens across the table of Jack Charlton.
Yeah. So,
although I know that's simplifying it down a bit, but there was, you know, some criticism even at the time of the way he was playing. But I can't really, like, I don't know who else there was to jump ahead of the other two lads.
I did think it was kind of interesting how much Mikko and Brian Cody actually have in common. Like, they were both two good players. Mikko probably more rated as a footballer than Brian Cody was as a hurler, but Mikko won 4 All-Irelands, Brian Cody won 3. They're both from, like, the counties which are, like, synonymous with their sports. They're both, like, they're both prevented from winning four All-Irelands in a row. They both kind of spawned, like, in an Alex Ferguson kind of way, like, they've both spawned a lot of other managers. Like, they've kind of inspired other players who played under them to go on and become managers. And yeah, there was one other one. Oh, yeah. A minor note, both of their autobiographies were written by Martin Breheny.
You've done your research, PJ.
Yeah. the Brian Cody, the Mikko Dwyer one has been sitting on my shelf for a while. I've never actually read it. I think somebody gave it to me. And that might be partially because the Brian Cody one isn't great. I think it was possibly written to stop someone else from writing it, from writing an autobiography. So yeah, maybe that has put me off reading the Mikko one.
Oh, look, I have to do one. But look, lads, this is thanks very much for input on that. But unfortunately, it's not going to be us. Fortunately, it's not going to be us who make the decision. It is up to the balls of the readers and listeners. You can vote now. It'll be up this evening and running on to Friday in the final. Two truly deserving finalists, Mikko Dwyer against Brian Cody. Who gets your vote? It's up to you. You can vote on our Instagram stories, on our Facebook stories, on site and on Twitter as well. and we'll reveal the winner on Friday afternoon. That is it from us for this week's podcast. If you have not listened to the full podcast, if you've just watched this video, be sure to subscribe on all good podcast platforms. You can find us by searching The Build Up on Balls.ie and all good podcast apps. And we will be back next week. But until then, mind yourself.